Right on the button, guys.
Right last here,
guys.
Stone for Kevin Martin. They want it on the button. The fans are on their feet. Kevin Martin goes out as a champion.
That's me laughing again. I wish one day, hi, everybody. It's Jungle Jim Jerome coming out with another episode of Inside Curling. One day we're going to give you all the sound bites from what we're saying just before we come on air. Okay. It's always funny. We welcome back again, of course, Warren Hansen, curling's biggest builder of all time and the greatest curler of all time. We haven't had that disputed. Although our guest that we're going to have on today, Kev, he may take you on with that. Of course, Kevin Martin. On the show today, boys, Warren's going to tackle the Gen Z, Warren? Is that what
Gen Z.
Yeah, the Gen Z problem, which are kids who are born after 1996. And you've got some interesting things to say about that. We got some COVID updates, some spiel updates. We put out two polls that we threw out there. We got some response, some interesting response. One of them was, 10 years from now, which region will be the most influential? And we left you to decide between Canada, Asia, USA, and Europe. The other poll was, which format might be best suited for a new curler? The four-man, the triples, or the doubles? Interesting results there. We got some great emails. One of, Warren, you took on a guy this week. Or not took him on, but I was trying to follow all the streams, but you guys were ripping back and forth on a bunch of emails. Trent from Newfoundland, who's really wants the amateur curler to get a little more opportunity than the high performance guy. He says the high performance guys got enough events. What's going on with the amateur curling? Warren, you're going to talk to us about that. We got a Connor who wants to know from Kevin and our guest, who I'll introduce shortly, about some practice. And then we got an email from a guy in Scotland about junior curling, where they are devastated about COVID, and he wants to try and get the junior curling going again there during COVID. But right now, before we start, one of my all-time favorite guys from all the years I did the patch. There was when you were curling, Kevin, I think you put the law down: no players allowed to go in the patch. Okay. Well, Johnny Morris, okay, said, "No, I'm going to the patch." Okay, Kevin, enough of that. And our guest this morning is John Morris. How are you doing, John?
Pretty good, Jim. Actually, it's funny. Kev would actually come, and we'd have a curfew. So he'd come and make sure Mark and Ben and I were tucked into bed. And then as soon as he checked on us, I'd sneak out the window and get into the patch.
Johnny, and what a guest you are. Let me just go down some of the stats. If I went down all your accomplishments, we'd have to extend the show by half an hour, but two-time Olympic gold, you won in 2010 with Kevin, and then you won the mixed in 2018 with Caitlin Laws, two-time world junior champ, Canadian mixed doubles champ, three-time Brier champ. You won the worlds as well. Of course, you went there three times. But there's some other stuff here too, Johnny, that I want to talk to you about. Kevin and I spoke last night that you're a world champion hunter, and a fisherman, pheasant hunting. We want to find out about that. Okay. How that all went on. You're a freaking chef. That came out of left field somewhere. No, Kev, you got to be reading the wrong Wikipedia page. He said, no, the guy's a chef, and all sorts of other things. Where are you now? First of all, Johnny, and how are you managing with COVID, and what's your team doing too? The Cooey team.
Well, we've tried to salvage a season here. We're able actually to get four great events in before Christmas here. So that was four more than I think a lot of us were expecting. So it's been a great start with Team Cooey. I took a few years off playing men's just to kind of start a family. And my wife and I have two wonderful kids right now. And I took a few years off curling for that. And, I've been really excited to be back playing men's. The juices are flowing again. I'm playing with a couple of my best friends in the game. And so that's been kind of rejuvenating. And right now I'm in Canmore, Alberta, locking down here with the family. It's a great place to be locked down because it's a pretty beautiful part of Alberta. And we're very lucky to have my folks, Earl and Maureen, are here visiting for 6 weeks. So we got a little support for the kiddos, just kind of locking down and waiting for better things to come in 2021.
Oh, way to go. You've got a better threshold with your parents than I did with mine. If it's 6 weeks, I lasted about 2 days, you know, with my parents.
Well, luckily we got a basement suite so that they're, we each have our own space, or else it would be a little dicey, I think.
Right. You brought up your dad, of course. And when we find out more and more about you all the time, your dad was Earl Morris, what broom did he invent, first of all? Because he was a very accomplished curler. And so was your great-grandfather, right? You got three generations there of curlers.
Yeah. They were both in the Brier. My dad invented the broom, the sliding broom called the stabilizer that Dave Nedewin very nicely used for many years and kicked my butt with it. So I was pretty happy my dad invented that to help Dave beat our butts. And also Colleen Jones used that a lot. So that's the broom he invented. Still going strong today.
Right on. Where did it all start for you, Johnny, in curling? I'm assuming it was from your days in Ottawa. And you're a multi-sport player there that I read. And you ended up curling. How did all that come about? And was it always going to be curling for you?
You know, I got to hand it to my folks for, you know, they never had a plan for us to just play a specific sport. They introduced us a lot of sports growing up. I think, you know, Kev was very good at this too, from playing with him. You know, he introduced his kids to a lot of sports and kind of like, okay, whichever one you really like and whatever one you're becoming really good at is what you can, you know, you guys choose to stick with it. So that was the same with our family. Played a lot of sports growing up. Loved baseball. I'd say baseball was probably my favorite sport, but I really enjoyed hockey too, and curling, obviously. And as I became into my, into my middle teenage years, curling, I was definitely better at curling. That was my best sport. So I kind of stuck at that. It always feels good to win some bond spiels when you're young and win some tournaments. And then, I was just kind of grew into that. And eventually you had to kind of give up. You don't have enough time to do hockey and curling. So I stuck with curling, and I'm kind of glad I did, because it's been a pretty awesome ride all these years.
One of the other things, besides all the eclectic other stuff that you do, you wrote a book. When did all that come about, and what was the premise for it when you decided to do it?
Well, that was kind of in the first few years I was playing with Kev. A friend of mine from the U.S., Dean Gemmel, got a hold of me because he wanted to take his curling to the next level in the U.S. And he said, John, I want to start training specifically for curling because I really want to give the Olympics a go from representing the U.S. And he asked me for some tips and some workout plans. And then after, you know, I share with him a lot of stuff that I did and that we did with our team. And then he said, well, you know, this is really interesting. He goes, not a lot of teams really focus on this. And it was one thing that our team really focused on with Kevin, was making sure we were in, you know, the best shape of any other team out there. And so, it was kind of his, he prompted me like, hey, would you ever think about writing a book for this? And as it turned out, you know, it probably took a year or so to put together. And then as it turned out, it was kind of perfect timing, because when we released it was the same year we qualified for the Olympics. So obviously our team was getting some attention going to the Olympics in Vancouver. And within 2 years, we sold every copy we printed. And it was kind of cool to write a book. And I think I still get messages today that young up and coming curlers are using those workout plans to train specifically for the game. So that's kind of cool.
Well, didn't that book actually, Johnny, didn't that book hit the bestsellers list? I think it did in Canada, did it not?
Yeah, I won't tell you how many copies you have to sell in Canada to get a bestseller list, but it did. We strategically printed enough that if we sold them all, it would be a Canadian bestseller list. So you bet it did, Kev. Thanks for pointing that out.
10, 15, you're good to go.
Oh, 10 or 15,000, Jim. Come on.
Attaboy. The book itself, has it stood the test of time? And I'm gathering it's all about instruction, right?
Yeah, you know, but we also wanted to keep it candid. You know, we didn't want it just to be, because the thing with training is that it's continually evolving. Like, I train so differently now than I did 10 years ago. And so it's continually evolving. So what we wanted to do is, there's some sports psych in there. There's some nutrition. There's some great stories of, you know, just curling on tour and how it's changed. And some of the guys I learned from, and some great stories I had, you know, just in the game. We wanted to kind of keep it a little candid that way as well. But it's evolved. We have an e-version that you can get at fittocurl.com. And we've provided some updates over the years with, you know, newer workout plans. So
what are you telling? What are you telling young curlers, Johnny, then, who want to start in the game? They want to get a little more competitive. Maybe one day they might be a high performance team. What advice would you give any of these young guys up and coming?
Well, the biggest advice, I'd say, maybe not be related specifically to fitness, but more so, I find that if you really put a lot of hard work, you know, if you can work harder than any other player out there that of your age group, then, you know, you see it with a guy like Sidney Crosby. He's gone to heights that no one's ever really gone to in hockey, and it's because of his work ethic. So I find work ethic in curling, you can really, you know, can take to the next level. But the other thing that I think is vital, that's really challenging for someone that's, you know, coming up through the junior ranks and trying to make that transition into the men's ranks or women's ranks, is you got to have a good, balance, work-life balance or school-life balance. And a lot of people, they focus 90% of the time on school or 90% of the time on work or 90% of the time on curling. And I feel like there's got to be a good balance there, because that keeps you a little bit more grounded. And I find the most successful curlers out there are guys that, are curlers that really can find a really good balance with everything in their life.
The other stuff that you did is totally interesting. It's funny you bring that up to talk about balance, because all your whole curling career, you were doing different things all along. And you're an avid hunter and a fisherman. The story of, and first of all, tell us the story about how you met your wife.
Well, that ties in right with chef school. I actually, I had an injury in curling. Actually, Kev had the same injury, and I guess it's quite common in curling, is a sports hernia. So I had an injury, and I had to take the last few months of the season off. And then I had the summer off, obviously. So I'm not the type of person, if you know me, that can sit around on his bed, just kind of, I get cabin fever pretty easily. So I've always loved cooking. I wanted to kind of take it to the next level and get a bit more formal training at it. And I found a really cool course that was offered in New York City, a city that I'd never been to in my life, about kind of more of a whole foods, natural cooking school, which was right up my alley, because it kind of combined nutrition and cooking. So this was in 2016 and in the spring. I went there, in April, and took an 8-month course there, and I had one of the best, most learning and most fun summers of my life living in New York City. Met so many great people, and one of those great people I met was my wife. We were just friends the whole summer. She ended up coming back and visiting me. We kind of dated long distance over that next year. And she's Polish and American. She has a Polish and American citizen. Now she's got her permanent residency here in Canada. But we met at school in the U.S. of all the places. And she was the best chef in the class. So she kind of won me over with her phenomenal cooking.
Right.
And, and we were, you know, we were both in our mid to late 30s at the time. So, one of the things we wanted to have a family. So we kind of got right down to business and we've had a couple kids here, since then. And now we're happily married, living in a wonderful home in the mountains and cooking up a lot of great food, I'll tell you.
So how far are you going with this cooking thing? Are you gonna crack a restaurant or something, you guys?
Well, we actually opened a bed and breakfast here. Part of our home we have in our house is a legal bed and breakfast kind of suite, and it's so we just opened it. kind of soft. It was a little challenging with COVID because we opened it right in the spring. So it's obviously been very challenging, but it's COVID friendly now. We offer pretty much a contactless breakfast. My wife pretty much takes care of most of the cooking because I'm still working at the fire station. And she is, it's been going. It's a bit of a soft opening, but if you guys are ever want to come to Three Sisters Bed and Breakfast in Canmore, look it up. We advertise on Airbnb, we'd love to have curling fans as guests. So there's a lot of cool curling paraphernalia down there.
Hey, Jimmy, is there a limit to the amount of plugs a person can put during a podcast?
That's okay.
We got fittocurl.com.
I know. I got to get some of our team sponsors in there, Kev, don't I?
Yeah. You got to drive like a NASCAR racer.
You're talking about bed and breakfast. That's almost what all those years we curled together, Johnny. And actually, Johnny started this, one of our first events ever, and maybe even the first event ever. You booked the A-frame on the water in Brockville. I think that was you. That was the first event, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I think it was in Brockville, right. The Shorty Jenkins event. So we go there, guys, and we go there, and John's booked this A-frame. I think it was $50 a night or $50 a week. And anyway, so it was a heck of a deal. So we go there, and sure enough, it's three, maybe four bedrooms in there, but the bedrooms are the sides of tables. And so we go in, and of course we're going, Johnny, like it was kind of sliding into the water. So it wasn't level. The cabin wasn't flat, and it had no heat. And at night it got real cold. And of course ice would form on the floor. So to have a pee in the middle of the night, the floor was crooked, and you'd slide into the wall. So you'd have to, while you're peeing, put your foot on the wall of the bathroom so you didn't slide into the wall. So So we put up, this is true, Jimmy, we put up with it. John and Mark put up for one night. They go and book a hotel and then stuck Benny and I in this A-frame for the rest of the event. But for the entire time we curled, we almost never stayed in hotels, Johnny. And a lot of it was you in the morning getting up and doing the bed and breakfast thing almost, because we ate pretty high off the hog when it came to our curling events for all those years.
Yeah, well, that's one of the challenges when you play in such small towns, Kevin, like Swan River, and there's not a lot of food options. So, that was one thing. And now it's very popular. A lot of teams do that. But I think we were one of the first teams to do that, where we had our own breakfast. We would make some fun breakfast. And I think it kind of helped with our team bonding too, because at night we'd play cards, and it was kind of nice to have a bit of a different environment than the Super 8 every weekend, you know?
A bottle of rum is the best way to get a team together,
John. Oh, we had some of that too. Okay, a little bit of rum and whiskey was, we definitely had a few of those bottles rolling around.
Well, amongst all the sort of different things that you do, when you're not curling or thinking about curling, what do you like to do? Pastime wise, how do you like to kill your time outside of curling?
You know, I feel like one of the things that really drew me to Alberta here is the mountains. I grew up in Canadian Shield and kind of environment in cabin country, Ontario, Quebec. That was my upbringing. Mm-hmm. And when I first came out here for the Canadian Juniors, in 1998, and then the Brier in 2002, I kind of fell in love with the mountains. I really enjoyed the wildlife out here. You know, we didn't have grizzly bears and as much moose and elk and mule deer, and that was something I really kind of took to. And that's one of the reasons I stayed in Alberta, is just because you can't find it anywhere else almost in the world, is the amount of wildlife the awe of the mountains here. Being able to get outside and just breathe in that fresh mountain air and hike, and I love camping and fishing and hunting. I know that Kev probably, I know the guys, you know, a few years, maybe when it was an Olympic year, sometimes I'd begrudgingly be playing in a bond spiel in September, because it was right in the middle of the elk rut, which was the best time to hunt. So I know that the boys sometimes got a little frustrated with me, because I would prefer trying to harvest an elk than go to a small bond spiel. But, that's just who I am. And And, you know, that's a deep passion of mine is the outdoors. And I feel very grateful to be able to have experienced what I've been able to experience here in Alberta. And when I'm not curling, you'll find me out with my family. I was ice fishing last weekend. I was just up in Lethbridge pheasant hunting with an old curling friend of mine, Brock Virtue. I brought my dad and my son up with me, and we just had a great time. So that's kind of what I enjoy doing in my free time.
Kevin always said that when you are curling, when you're deep into it, you know, playing spiels and going at it full time, that no one could touch you talent wise in the world. He said the problem was if Johnny had one of the other 100 things that he has going on the side, he said, you got to tell me this story, Johnny, about taking a job at a fishing store so you could buy a boat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a good one.
Johnny, you got to remember, Johnny, when after you're done, I get to talk too.
was this while I was playing with you, Kev?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so I'm working at the fire station as a volunteer. This was probably 2006 or 7, I would say. And Bass Pro Shops opens in just north of Calgary. Right. Okay, so guys at the, you know, and you got to remember the guys I work with, they're avid hunters and fishers too. So they come in, like we used to practice in the back, like just outside our fire hall. We'd set up a target back there. And that's how I got into bow hunting is we would target practice back there after training. So a couple of guys came in, they said, Johnny, you won't believe it. Bass Pro Shops opening in just north of Calgary. And I remember my captain came in at the time, Brent Paquette, and he said, John, he goes, I just applied for a job there. I said, really? He goes, yeah. He goes, you won't believe it. You get 40% off if you're an employee of Bass Pro. And I said, wow. I said, well, that would save me a lot of money on my outdoor gear. All and right. I was just kind of getting into the outdoors in Alberta at the time, because I'd only lived here a few years. So a few of us from the fire station applied. I ended up, we got the job and I worked in a, it's funny. I worked in a, I knew nothing about, it was GPS and fish depth finders for fish. Right. And I knew nothing about it, but I was doing sales for that because they train you for a week and boom, you're on the floor. I think I only worked there for 6 months. I never took a paycheck home because it went directly to what I was buying there. And I bought a boat, a Bass Tracker that was about, and I saved about $7,000 off it. And I definitely got the reward for spending the most amount of money as a employee there. So I didn't think they minded that as a Bass Pro. But is that how you remember it, Kev? Or?
Yeah, well, kinda. Yeah, the part where you got the job is accurate, I think. And you're right, Jimmy. Nobody touched John Morris when John is focused on curling. Best curler right. in the history of our sport. Problem is, if Johnny got sidetracked and actually got focused on something else. So that year, John probably worked at Bass for 6 months, didn't make a curling shot for 6 months because he was all about getting this boat. The problem was, everybody knows that when you get a boat, there's other things you need. You need a trailer. Right. You need a truck. Right. But so it's really funny. Benny got a kick out of it. Like, we just couldn't get Johnny to focus on anything because he needed to get this boat. And after a few months of working, and he got the boat, is in the parking lot at Bass Fishing, but of course doesn't have a trailer yet. So how do you get the boat home back to your house in Chestermere? You were in Chestermere at the time, Johnny.
You bet.
So that might have been a little after 07. But anyway, a beautiful house on the lake in Chestermere. But anyway, and then somehow you had to get that boat to your place because you didn't have a trailer or a truck. And then so it was a gradual need the boat first, but then you need a way to haul it and get it to the lake so you can have some fun with it. So anyway, those are always the fun parts of curling with John Morris. Wasn't the when you're focused on curling, it was when you're focused on something else.
Well, and it's interesting you mentioned that, Kev, because the savings account definitely took a dip that season because you know, that's for sure. But I think that's a challenge. I know it's for other people too, but for sure for me, when you play on tour for so long and, you know, one thing I love about the game is the big events, like a Breyer under the lights, you know, the Olympic trials, the one we had in Edmonton. That was one of the most phenomenal events you could ever play in as a curler. Obviously the Olympics, but it's hard to really get up for, you know, when you've played on tour for 15, 20, 25 years, the smaller events that, you know, it feels a little bit like Groundhog Day. And I know it's one of the biggest struggles I've struggled with throughout my career is that, you know, okay, you have event that's, you know, it's you're playing, you know, you're playing Turd Ferguson on Sheet C in Swan River. And you know,
Turd Ferguson,
great curler, that guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was a challenge for me. And you know, that's why I think taking a few years off and kind of recharging the batteries, playing with a couple new players, has really been good for that. And I feel like, you know, I don't know if I'd want to play for 10 more years, cause that would definitely become a challenge again. But, you know, for the short term and the next few years, I'm did you ever struggle with that, Kev? Did you ever struggle with, cause you seem to be pretty even keel when it came to that, but I know that was something I always struggled with was, you know, like the games in the small events against not so tough teams, you know?
Yeah, I was in the same boat as you, Johnny. I was just having fun with you. But you're right.
Yeah.
There's no question after a certain amount of time. The big events, even my last year that I played, I love the big events. That Players' Championship, the last event I ever played, I was keyed up big time for it. But most of the time, you saw that last couple of years. Couldn't focus to make enough shots. So you're bang on, for sure. The bigger the event, the bigger the prize, the more interest, the more focus when you get older. I think a young person can get excited all the time about sport. But as you get older, you kind of focus. You need your focus to be on the big events. But
yeah, it's like any other big athlete, you know. A golfer gets a little more keyed up for the Masters than he does for the Utah Open, you know, or something. Mm-hmm. We're gonna put you to work today a little bit, Johnny, or you're going to stay on for the rest of the show, which we really appreciate, and get your comments on a bunch of lively topics. Before we do that, then, I want your best memory with the Martin team, okay? And then if you can't think of that, I want this story about the smelly, rotten, dirty socks that you used to keep playing with, that whole deal.
Well, the obvious great best memory was winning the Olympics. But I think the best memory from those Olympics was when we sat the next day as a team, 10 rows up, when Sidney Crosby scored the winner. You know, next to Kevin, Ben, and Mark, and we couldn't even get up because every time we got up to go get a drink, there was 10 of them handed to us from our a bunch of Canadian fans. So that was such a great memory with that team. But my favorite memory from that team, and what I really miss still to this day, because I've never been on a team and I don't know a lot of other teams that do this, was being on the road, playing cards with Kevin and Ben and Mark and our coach, Jules Ochar, having a whiskey, watching the Oilers or, you know, hockey in the background. It's interesting how it goes. That's what I really miss is, you know, those times being with the team, telling stories, old stories of being on tour. And, you know, we had such a great group of guys with great stories and we had so many laughs. And that's what I missed the most about that team was, and I hope that before Kevin is going to be using a cane, which, you know, to, you know, I want to make sure we maybe get one or two more or have an event we plan every year with that old team. And we bring the old coach along just so we can, for the most part, have a whiskey together again and play some cards and tell some good stories again.
Super cool.
And that was the truth about that A-frame, Johnny. You remember that bathroom?
Oh,
it was dropping into the lake. So the floor was on a 20 degree angle.
Well, that was back in the day when they didn't have like, now you get to see all the pictures of all the rooms. And that was so long ago that I just saw cabin rentals. I said, oh, that sounds cool. No pictures. And it was, what I didn't realize was it was summer cabin rentals. It wasn't meant for, you know, shoulder season in September. So, yeah, that was a good one. That was a good start, eh?
That was a hell of a start. Yeah, yeah, that was perfect.
We went undefeated, though. We rolled the table.
Well, we didn't lose a game for our first, I don't even know, 36 games we won in a row or something to start that to start it off with our team. I think something like that. It was a crazy number.
It was interesting because there was a lot of like, will this work? I wonder how this team's going to do. And then we're like 36-0. And they're like, I think it's going to be a pretty good foursome here.
36 games in a row?
It was something high like that, Jimmy. It was and that was from when we started. We didn't, our first loss was
like November.
Yeah, like November. It was crazy. Yeah. It was crazy.
Why did you go off that team, Johnny?
Well, you know what? And I was thinking about that this morning, and I think that a few things happened. You know, we were on top of the world for, I think, our first 5 years, Kev, we played together. You know, the Olympics were 2010, and even the year after the Olympics, we were still, I remember winning the Players Championship and the Capital One Cup that year. And then the next year or two, you know, it was when we started not playing as well as a team. I think the only guy that really still played really well was Mark. Mark was, you know, just steady Eddie. But Kev had a bad injury, had a tough injury. And I was kind of getting a little bit, you know, as we mentioned before, I was a little bit like having trouble getting up for the games. And I need to have an edge out there and I need to be fired up. And then I'll play 90% curling. And if I'm not, and I'm a little bit tuned out, I'll dip into 80%. And that just wouldn't cut it. And I know that Kev had a bit of an injury and he struggled there for a month or two. I remember the one Canada Cup we had, you know, we went 1-6 and I felt after that season, I was losing my passion, my soul for the game. And, you know, unfortunately, if obviously hindsight's 2020, because if you look at the stats from the 2013 Olympic trials, okay, I don't know if you have a stats guy in here or not, but I'm almost positive. Okay, Kevin Martin was the number one skip or tied with Brad Jacobs, one of the two, at the end of the week. I was the number one third. Mark Kenny was the number one second. And Ben, you know, was the number one or number two lead. And I think I think that, you know, we were all having maybe a little bit of doubt in the team. And, you know, so in hindsight, even though like I was able to kind of rekindle my passion playing with Jim Cotter and those guys, I might have been definitely thinking, you know, overachieving when we made that final to some extent. But, you know, I think I've actually had this conversation with Ben and Mark a lot. And if we could have had the wherewithal and the vision as a team to be like, listen, we need a break from each other just for, you know, like we're kind of plateauing here a bit. And we need a break. And if we can take a 3-month break, not do any sponsor stuff, do what you got to do to recharge our own batteries and to get remotivated and to kind of develop a really, get that hunger back. And if we could have came back into that season like that, there's no doubt in my mind that we could have, you know, and I don't want to take anything away from the Jacobs team because they were on a different level that week as well. But I think it would have been one hell of a battle. And I wouldn't have doubted it one bit if we had stayed together after taking a bit of a break and keeping that team together in 2013 for those 2013 trials. There's not a doubt in my mind, especially after seeing the way we all played at those trials individually, that we could have went to one more Olympics together. So that's how I feel about it.
Cool. Very cool. Okay, Johnny, you're going nowhere. We got some stuff to talk about.
Okay.
We got to thank Warren for he's the guy who does all the heavy lifting here during the week, answering all the emails. So if you want to email us, you can do it at insidecurling@gmail.com. And we're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Check us out there. Rod Paulson from In-House Strategies is the guy who handles all our social media stuff. And it's very good. It's very active. And if you need any media things at all, Rod's the guy to go to. Thanks everyone for all the emails. We're loaded up with them, and obviously we can't get to all of them, but we will tell you this. The shows have now gone to a place where almost all the content from these shows, when we don't have a guest or even when we do, are based on your emails. So we thank everybody for that. We encourage you to keep emailing us. We did a Zoom call. That's a while ago now with the club out of Detroit. And if you'd like us to do a Zoom call with your club, we'd love to do it. Not individual people. Okay. We've had a couple of requests for that. You know, yeah, I'd love to sit down with you guys. I think our next one, Warren, is we're looking at Belgium, aren't we? That wants to do a Zoomer.
Yeah, we're working on that right now. It's been a very interesting exchange with the people in Belgium, and they're trying to pull together virtually people from every avenue of curling in Belgium to be part of this call, and looking forward to doing that sometime here in the next couple of weeks.
Okay, so let's get right into this, Warren. You had there was an interesting talk or email or conversation you had with someone about this Gen Z problem. That's going on, and it's kids who were born after kids. I can't believe this. Yeah, it's kids who were born after 1996, and the issue is that those should be the ones we want to get involved in curling, the young kids, but it's not happening.
Well, as you may recall, last week we had a fairly spirited discussion about the future of curling in Canada and around the world, and what's happening, in particular with youngsters. And we got a lot of response from that discussion. But I thought, by a strange coincidence, the day after we taped this show, there was a huge article that was initiated in the Washington Post, and it was titled "Sports Has a Gen Z Problem," and it was written by Rick Maas. And actually, that article was picked up by Post Media in Canada and did run in some of the Canadian newspapers. Very interesting article, and I'll start by quoting some of the items that were mentioned and lead that into a discussion. But starts out, "The bulky and bankable North American sports industry, built in towers of cash and lucrative American television contracts, is confronting a Generation Z problem. The nation's youngest cohort is fundamentally different from the generations that preceded it. The challenge is being met with some sense of urgency in corners of the sports world, and in some cases, a sense of alarm. Failing to hook young people might not devastate today's events, but it threatens to muddle the future of every league, every team, and every sport in North America." Some of the things I think that was noted in that article: everything must be shorter and designed so that participants or viewers are engaged and having fun at all times. Good example is the interest by this age group in short videos on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Snapchat versus a 2.5 hour or longer televised game. Also associated with the article was a very interesting chart, and I'll make reference to that chart to some degree because it's alarming. And this is looking at some of our major sports today with game action, non-action, and commercials during a telecast. The worst is the NFL. There's 18 minutes of game time, 140 minutes of non-action, and 50 minutes of commercials. Baseball isn't much better, 22 and a half minutes of game time, 150 minutes of non-action, and 52 minutes of commercials. The National Hockey League, that we're most familiar with in Canada, probably is one of the better ones. They have 83 minutes of actual time versus 56 minutes of non-action and 38 minutes of commercials. But I think as we go forward, that's a prime example. If we're going to attract Gen Zers and millennials, certainly under the age of 35, to all sports, and curling being one of them, there has to be some way determined to have more action and less delay, because I think otherwise the younger people simply aren't going to be interested in either watching it or participating. The challenge is about finding Gen Z is attracting and keeping their attention, as I think as I've mentioned. Curling needs to move down this path with how the sport is offered overall. And what do you need to do to get Gen Zers, that's a tongue twister, or millennials into the arena? And maybe it has to start with an app. Idea I had about 8 years ago was for the CISA Champions events to develop an app. Some of these other sports are doing things. The NHL, interesting enough, did launch a Generation Z focus group last year of 15 young people who met on Zoom and chatted on Slack. The league peppered them with questions and took notes. The question is this what curling should be doing as well, to find out directly from these younger people how we can get them interested in the sport of curling as players and as fans? Right. Kev, what do you think?
Wow. Those are some interesting numbers. You know, I'm a huge baseball fan. And you're right. Late in the game, when they start changing the pitchers around, it is hard to stay focused, even for me. And you don't get a bigger ball fan than I am. But you're right. To keep a young mind excited, the last couple of innings of a ball game is tough when you're changing it. They have changes, so you have to at least pitch to three batters before you switch pitchers. But still, you know, it's such a slow motion game at the end. So you're right. And curling, how do we worry about that? And certainly more action. And John and I have talked about this at length over the years, and that's the young people at a curling event. How do we get them more engaged? And maybe an app situation. Certainly getting more activity, music in the building, keeping that's what I love about mixed doubles. The action's quick. There's not a lot of time between shots. I think that's really important too in the four-person game to move it to every end being timed. I was actually watching Johnny with Team Cooey this year playing botcher. John, you might have to help me out. I think it was in Banff. But the game, if you remember, John, it started really fast. Like the game looked like it was going to go an hour and 20 minutes. It was incredible. The first three, four ends just went cruising by. But then everybody banked up a bunch of time. And oh my goodness, the last four ends took an hour and 40 minutes. It was awful. And two of the best teams in the world of curling, if it would have been timed per end, that fast pace could have went through the whole eight ends and it would have been fantastic entertainment. I think something like that. John, what do you think?
Well, definitely. I think, you know, with the inclusion of mixed doubles is huge because that's an hour and a half, cutting it down from some 2.5 to 3 hour games. So, you know, adding a sport like that, I think is pretty vital for getting the young people involved. And I think, we're making some progress. We used to be 12 ends, now we're 8 ends. I don't know if going much less than that's going to be helpful, because then it's going to be hard to get your best team winning all the time. But certain things, like you mentioned, Warren, having an app. I know that, guys I hang around at the fire station, they're watching a football game and they're able to, like, there's polls going on, like how many points are they going to score in this drive? I think something like that, where you can either, vote on how many points. Is it going to be a blank end? Is it going to be, who's going to get a deuce? I know that there's even betting websites, and I don't want to be, condoning too much gambling here, but I think that what would get a lot of people interested, and young people interested, is if they could actually predict what botcher is going to get a deuce this end, or they're going to get a three, and odds on if they would that team getting that and having the opportunity to even make a wager on that. I know that that is something that's really popular.
So the question,
and I don't want, I think it's important to talk about that, because, you know, the people I hang around with, half of them love watching games because they like to be the pros, and they like to predict what's happening out there. And I think if having an app or something where you can incorporate a little bit of that into curling might be pretty cool.
I think there's so many things that have to be considered and looked at. And I keep talking about this big room discussion where all interested parties have got to get together and got to start talking about this stuff, because if we don't, 10 years from now, I hate to think of where things might be if we don't start attracting younger people to the sport as players and as fans. And I think we just look statistically what's happened, and we've got to do something.
So the question, Johnny, is do you think curling is doing enough to get young curlers involved? The sense I'm getting is they're not. And a bunch of, like, one of the things they always talk about now with all sports, including curling, is kids are at home playing video games, and these, e-games is huge, So what do you think, Johnny? Are you worried about it, or are you happy with the way it's going, and you believe the growth is there trying to get new curlers?
One of the challenges with curling is that a lot of the governing bodies and the people that are that make up these governing bodies, whether it's internationally or Canadian, a lot of them are an older generation. They're not your generation Z or even X, so essentially they, and when making change, when you have those people that control most of the decision-making processes for these governing bodies, takes a long time. And because that's traditionally how change, changes was made. And I think that some changes, especially to get the younger people involved, I think are necessary. That doesn't mean we have to do a full revamp of our sport, but I definitely think that there could be some great changes in our sport that maybe, for example, more interactive with the curlers. Like, I love being mic'd up and get questions from the crowd or questions from the audience or the fans watching back home. I think that's great. You know, maybe we need to get a bit more interactive with that. And maybe we can incorporate a bit more exciting things throughout the game. I know that's slowly happening, but it would be nice to see some of these Generation Z, as you say, Warren. It'd be nice to see some of these Generation Z people themselves, these youth, these younger folks involved in the decision-making process, because they would have the best ideas. And rather than having 50 to 80 year olds making decisions a lot of the time for these governing bodies, is really make sure you incorporate some younger people in those decisions, because that should be a big market. And if we want our game to continue to grow and thrive, we're going to need that.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of throwing a bunch of things on the table with this kind of a group and say, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? What are your thoughts? And in exchanging a lot of ideas, both from within the sport now and from people who aren't involved, I think is how it's solved. But I believe, going back to the original question, is enough being done right now? I won't be critical probably in what they're trying to do at the association end, but what I will be critical is the fact it's the same old, same old. We're not coming up with new approaches. And I use it as we're trying to drive that round peg into the square hole. And if we hit it enough times and hard enough, we know it's going to go in.
Right. I don't know how, Warren, you're going to be able to pull this off with trying to get less time when curling is like every other sport where it's sponsor driven and the advertisers are what makes it go. So I don't know how you're going to ever be able to go to the advertiser and say, we're showing less commercials. We want all your dough.
There has to be a new way figured out of how to fulfill these sponsors, because the same thing, commercials are yesterday's news. No one under 50 is watching 30-second commercials, or not even 15-second commercials. So the advertisers and sponsors have to be fulfilled in a different way. And if you look on the internet, you can see that's happening with a lot of things. It's pop-up ads, it's banner ads, it's product placement, it's discussion of product. The key thing for the fulfillment of a sponsor is you want your fulfillment to be part of the show. Because the way we're going today, who watches commercials? You're either PVRing out of it or you're flipping to something else when the commercial is on. And I know myself personally, if you ask me out of a bank of 2.5 minutes of commercials, what I just watched, I probably couldn't even tell you. So there's got to be a new approach, a new way. And I think with video streaming becoming the future, that's going to force that to happen. But right now, we're still kind of doing the same old, same old.
Right. We may go to these Amazons or Apple, who may step in and go, look, you can stream this, pay a few bucks, and there's less commercials. Okay, we got to move along. We've got a couple other things. First of all, COVID not going very well, certainly here in Alberta, Johnny and Kevin. The cases are on the rise. I read last night some more restrictions here in Edmonton. They're laying the law down about social gatherings at all, and have really reduced everything back from any gatherings at all, whether it's at church or wedding receptions or funerals or whatever. So it's getting pretty serious. Warren, what's the update that you have for us on COVID?
Well, as you suggest, it's not good. I've got a bit of a rundown from across the country, starting with Atlantic Canada. I've heard from Lawrence Forbes in Moncton, and it's a moving target. Right now, he tells me that curling has pretty much been shut down in New Brunswick until the 4th of December, and then a real reevaluation. Parts of Nova Scotia are shut down for 10 days. Things seem to be continuing more or less as usual in Prince Edward Island, but of course, they have blocked pretty much everyone from going into that province unless they go into a 14-day quarantine. Quebec and Ontario, along with Manitoba, things aren't very good there, as we well know it. Most of the clubs are not operating. There may be some in the outlying areas that are still functioning to some degree, but probably not many. Word has it that Manitoba is about to make an announcement in the next few days too regarding their playdowns, potentially for men and women being a combined event with fewer teams, but that remains to be seen whether any of those provincial playoffs can even happen from my point of view. In Saskatchewan, effective November 27th, all clubs, leagues, competitions are on pause until December 17th. That's from Karen in Martinsville. We also know there was an outbreak at a seniors and master bond spiel held at the Highland Club in Regina, November 13th to 15th. And that was people over 50. So that wasn't a good thing to be happening there. Interesting enough, here in British Columbia, we have a little different set of circumstances. Most of the clubs here are still operating. Some aren't, but most are. So things are moving forward here. I just got a note while we were going through things this morning, a release out of Scotland suggesting that they have canceled all Scottish curling competitions scheduled for January and February. So all their playdowns for 2021 have been canceled.
Yikes.
So Kevin, you want to give us a little update in Alberta and what's happening on the event scene and on the world scene in one case?
Yeah, as of course, as Johnny knows, there's not a lot going in Alberta right now, which is it's really too bad in curling, but also hockey rinks, all that kind of stuff is are shut down. Not shut down, but on pause until the middle of December. So there'll be new word coming out at that point going into the Christmas season. Can people get out and do some stuff? We'll see. You know, you're right. The case numbers are increasing, but everybody would have thought that would happen anyway. Once it's cold out and you're inside more. So I guess we'll see in the middle of December, and hopefully we can get the clubs back open again. And, you know, I've talked about it a couple of weeks where I sat behind the glass and watched curling leagues happen. I watched the people walk in the building. I watched them put their shoes on. I watched them hit the ice and I watched them play. And I just didn't see where you couldn't stay 6 feet apart, at least, if not even more, easily in our sport. So, you know, it's disappointing to see this happen and a bit perplexing because, like I say, I sat and watched. You know, you can't get better information than actually just sitting and watching, and it was too bad to see that happen. Right. Okay, a little bit of curling going on around the world. Not as last week, not as much as we'd certainly like to see, but there is a WCT Latvian Mixed Doubles Curling Cup going on in Riga, Latvia. Dana Baroni and Arnis Veldemanis beat Leva Udziti and Artis Zentelis in the final 7-5. And I want to go over to the Korean Curling Championships because remember last week, while we were taping, the ladies' final was on and I didn't know who ended up winning. In the men's, we talked about Chan Min Kim lost the final to Jung Suk Jung 12-10 in an extra end. And on the women's side, Eun Jun Kim, she actually had a birthday last week. They beat Eun Chi Jim in the final 7-5, and that's the update that I couldn't give to you at that time. This week, it's the Korean Curling Championships mixed doubles. And that final just happened. Hai Ji Zhang and Yu Jin Seong beat Yu Jin Song and Jae Jin 6-5 in the final. So a good... yeah, I know. I tell you what.
You know what, Kev? Can someone ever give you an update of, you know, can the team not be from Ireland one time for you? And, you know, you got Korea, you got Latvian names or Korea.
Wait till we get to Russia.
This is bigger than Olympic gold, man, if you can pull this off.
That's right. But at least there is curling going on. And that brings to another story, and we'll bring Johnny in on this as well, but during the 2018 Olympics in Pyeongchang, there was word out that there were lots of sort of problems with the Korean Curling Federation and what was going on there. And a report came out Monday that the former vice president, Kim Kyung-do, his daughter, Kim Ming-jung, and her husband, Jan Bang-seok, have been sanctioned for their investigation into abuse allegations conducted. So, and that is kind of what we heard back in those Olympics. And I guess it's been a very long time coming out, but we had heard there were lots of trouble with the women's team that ended up winning silver. And I think it was noticeable to everybody who watches curling really closely how the Kim team won the silver medal. And then they kind of disappeared out of the scene. And they weren't allowed on social media after the Olympics in 2018. And actually, the skipper ended up, Eun Jun Kim, had to practice by herself, wasn't allowed to practice with the team. So lots of different stuff going on there. They're getting to the bottom of it. The team's winnings never went to the team. Their promo money, like when they would do a show speaking engagement for sponsors or whatever, there would be money paid to them, of course, to do that work, but it was paid to the team, to team leaders. and it never actually got to the team. The money never got to the athletes. So it's a big controversy right now. They're getting to the bottom of it, but John, I want to bring you in a little bit because not on this, we don't want to get too edgy here, but I would like to see from the athlete's point of view, because of course you won gold in Pyeongchang. Did you hear anything on the ground about this stuff while you were there?
You know what? I heard not much while I was there. I definitely heard some things after. We were pretty focused on our own discipline and our own team. But I do know a few of the coaches, the Canadian coaches that were involved. And I think they were, it was interesting the way they were treated. It was just different than maybe the way Canadians would treat coaches. But I think there's definitely a cultural difference there. I don't know if disappointing is the right word, but the most challenging thing about this is that this women's team, I watched them, because I was done mixed doubles at the time, and I was amazed at how good they were. Like, you didn't really hear from them too much going into the Olympics. And then they come in and they're having the time of their lives, the garlic girls, as everyone was calling them. And they were playing really well. They were having fun. And I feel like from what I've heard, it's really unfortunate that, there was a lot of things that usually a team, the teams I know in the rest of the world, they have control over how they work with sponsorship, over prize money, and it's a very democratic process, right? It's, you have team meetings, you talk about things, and it's not, one person or one leader that's kind of making all those decisions. And it's really unfortunate because here's a group of girls that were doing really well and had a really promising future for probably many Olympics to come. And it seems like that's kind of been taken out of their hands now. And as a result, we haven't really heard from them since. And I really hope that when all the dust settles here, that they're given another chance to really have some fun at the game and reach their potential, because they did so well in Korea. And I think a lot of curling fans in the world would love to see them back there.
So just to be clear, Kevin, when you bring this up about abuse or allegations, we're talking about money, like money not being given to this team, or?
Correct. So no, that's right. Exactly, Jimmy. It's abuse of the team in a leadership role.
From what I heard, Jim, was that the leaders were being very controlling and not, as I said, as Kev mentioned, not giving any prize money to the team, or right, very little. And also for engagements, they weren't getting any of that money coming back to them. And one or two of the team stood up and said, "Hey, what's going on here? This isn't right." And that's where they got like totally very reprimanded, and that's what created all of this. And it's probably a good thing that person did that. I don't know exactly who it was, whether it was the skip mm-hmm. or whoever, but it's probably a good thing that they did that, because I think 20 years ago, without social media or anything like that, that wouldn't have been done. And I think that that's unethical mm-hmm. and not fair. And it's good that they did an investigation in it. I think it gives a lot of us faith in the Korean sports system that they investigated it and seemed to have come to a positive conclusion here. But I think that that type of thing in sport, with coaches and leaders that are doing that to their athletes, still there's no place for that in today's world in sport. And I think it's good that they got hopefully some positive solution out of this.
That brings us to our poll. This is a good segue. We put out a couple of poll questions. The first one was 10 years from now, which region will be the most influential? And the options were Canada, Asia, USA, and Europe. And the response we got was kind of predictable and then kind of unpredictable, Warren. The numbers were 111 for Canada, 31 for Asia, 17 for USA, and 1 for Europe. Give us your quick thoughts on that, Warren.
Yeah, I'll translate that into percentages, which is maybe a little clearer, because the numbers you just quoted, we had a few more since I forwarded that to you. Canada was at 68%, Asia 20%, USA at 9%, and Europe at 2%. So that's rather interesting. I want to talk about the other poll as well and then give you a little summary from one of our participants in the poll. Mm-hmm. The other one was, which format might be the best suited to bring new curlers into the sport? Four-person curling, 52%, triples, 16%, doubles, 33%. And I find in both cases some very interesting results. And I think one of the people that participated in the poll summed it up fairly well by saying, regarding the influence poll, had this poll been done 10 years ago, I doubt there would have been any votes for the USA or Asia. So this should be reviewed with some alarm by Curling Canada and curlers in Canada. Same goes for the question of format. For other to have a combined 50%, that is mixed doubles and triples, this should be very telling to the powers that be. The people are to some degree looking for a change. And I do find both interesting as well from the point of view that it isn't suggesting that the masses out there believe the same old is what needs to go on into the future. So I just want to also add that we invite people to join our Facebook group. Please go there and become a member. We have a lot of exclusion discussions that have gone on, and we're going to do a lot more in the future. I think this one discussion last week, we had over 50 posts on it. So please join us in these polls that we're going to be putting out on a regular basis. Kevin, what do you think of the results of these polls? Is it alarming to you?
Alarming, maybe, but expected. When it comes to the influence in the world of curling, for people that just can't see the Asian countries climbing, I just don't think they're paying attention. They're just getting very, very strong, and there's no denying it. It's just the way it is. U.S. is getting stronger, and that's where the big explosion could happen in curling. But 10 years is a fair question. Will it happen in 10 years? That's worth arguing. Maybe, maybe not. The percentage, though, when it comes to promoting curling at a young age, I believe that if we do this exact same poll 2 years from now, triples will be around 30 to 40%. Triples is going to be a huge learning tool in the sport going forward because you take turns at being the skip. And sticking a kid at lead position because they haven't curled as much or whatever the case may be makes no sense to me. And that's why I think triples, if we do this exact poll, the triples will double or triple in the next 2 to 3 years. And mixed doubles, of course, I love the game. It's great because it brings a lot of athleticism into the sport. And both players have to learn to be able to hit and be able to draw and sweep and judge and all those things as well. So it doesn't surprise me that it's about 50-50. But, you know, four-person curling, you're going to see that drop down as far as bringing new curlers into the game. I think triples is fantastic.
What do you think, Johnny, when you hear those two polls? First one, again, was which region will be the most influential? Surprising numbers are Asia is up there. And which format is best suited for new curlers? Four-man's only 52%. Triples, 16%, and doubles, 33%.
Well, I think it's all very positive. You know, if we want our game to grow, I think a lot of people that would have responded to this, I don't know how many international fans or responses you got, but if we want our game to grow around the world, then we need influences from Asia and the US. Those are the two biggest markets in the world. And that's what's promising. In the past, it's been mostly Canadian and a little bit of Europe. So the fact that we're getting more, you know, more tournaments, more Bonspiels in the U.S. and especially in Asia, I think that's awesome. It's great to see them picking it up because that just provides us all with more opportunity. So I think that's fantastic. When it comes to the type of game, triples, you know, you could create more of an all-around player with triples, and it's a no-brainer, and it engages kids more than, as Kev said, if you got a guy playing lead for the first 3 years that he curls, and that's kind of boring. And mixed doubles is a lot of fun. I think what's interesting about it is you learn, there's not a lot of sports in the world where you have to learn to play with someone of the other opposite gender. There's very little of that in the world. A lot of there's so much going on in the world with like technology and everyone being on their phones all the time. Having to engage and communicate with another team member and also team member of the opposite sex, I think is awesome. That is something we are going to be missing in the future. So to provide that avenue for people, I think that's going to be, people are going to really start seeing how beneficial that can be.
Cool. Warren, we got a good show, Phillips. Good show. You had a back and forth with a guy named Trent, and I guess to sum it up, Trent was saying there's not enough happening with amateur curling, and the high performance guys get all sorts of events that they get to play in. So you had this sort of a bunch of long emails. I read them all last night, back and forth with this guy. Give us your thoughts on what he was talking about, Warren, and your reaction to it.
Well, first of all, Trent is in St. John's, Newfoundland, Trent Skeins, and he's a very well-known curler there. And I believe he's very involved with the St. John's Curling Club. So he's a man who the curling world in Newfoundland, Labrador for sure, know quite well. This was an interesting exchange back and forth, and I'm going to read part of what he suggested or said to me. And it was the issue of a Brier dream for a curler in Newfoundland and what that's all about, and sort of, is that dream really not realistic anymore, and what should happen going forward? So I'll just quote something he said here. Speaking from a competitive amateur perspective, I agree with you that 100% that a division needs to happen and has been needed for a while. Obviously, the blended pro-amateur format is causing Curling Canada to dance around trying to satisfy its provincial MAs, and in doing so has implemented band-aid solutions that are ripe for abuse, like the combination of the birthright and free agent rules resulting in the PEI men's team from last year basically not coming from PEI. In fact, under a rule modification that was passed at the Newfoundland Curling Association in June, there was a team out of Alberta that declared itself to be playing in the upcoming Newfoundland Tankard, composed of three birthright players and one from Alberta as the free agent, with no residents of Newfoundland, Labrador whatsoever. As such, these policies, which arise from the lack of national separation of pro and amateur, may be well-intentioned and workable in theory, but quickly become absurd in practice. Another thing I want to say, he said, is I am bone weary of trying to stop a freight train with my bare hands to realize my dream of playing in the Brier. And that freight train he refers to is Brad Gushu. So this discussion went back and forth of he wanted to play in the Brier. And if there is a division that comes forward in the future, he wanted the Brier brand to remain as the amateur event and for a new event to be determined for the amateurs. And my point to him was that the Brier brand is 90 years old, and going forward, regardless of what happens, that should always be the Canadian men's and women's championship, the Scotties, and the Brier, the men's. And maybe the Canada Cup is the name that is applied to an amateur event. And I suggested to him as well that to get this going initially, you could have the amateur and the Brier event, which would be the professionals, but that the winner of the amateur event, which could be the Canada Cup, would in fact get a berth in the Brier, to at least that there would still be a connection. And after we went back and forth on this for a while, I think Trent more or less began to agree that that was probably the route that made the most sense going forward, because as we've suggested many times, right now it's a mess. And the fact that we have about 8 teams participating in a Brier every year that have absolutely no chance, again, I will emphasize, makes little or no sense.
Right. So, Johnny, we love to hear from curlers. That this topic has been going on since day one on our show, and it's a bunch of really almost controversial discussion all the time. What are your thoughts on the Brier now, John, and the format of it, and your reaction to some of this stuff that Trent's talking about with amateur curling?
Well, I think that curling teams have gotten so good that's the reason why you have more discrepancy between your Brad Gushus and maybe the next team in Newfoundland. It's just that what's happened to the game is you've gotten curling teams have gotten very, very good, especially the top teams. I think a lot of people, what they love about the Brier is the fact that they're able to represent their province. One thing I love seeing about it is, wearing your provincial colors, people coming from your province and supporting you no matter, which team it is. And I think that's something I'd love to see stay. Like, I think it's been a little bit tough seeing, the wildcard team in there, just because, you don't really have a provincial affiliation per se. And I would hate to see that ever leave. But I think that when you can enter a curling season, anyone in the country, knowing that you have a chance to represent your province at the Brier, even though it's tougher now than it was 50 years ago, that's just the way the game has evolved. And there's no real changing that. And I don't think it would take away from someone who wins PEI to go to the Brier, knowing that their chances went from maybe 5% of winning it back in 1960 to 1% now. I think they're still going to have a great time. I think they're still going to really be proud that they won their province and to get that PEI jersey. And I think that I don't think we ever want to lose that, because that's the tradition of the Brier that I think has some really good draw to it and is what people really remember, you know, from their Brier experience. So I hope that never leaves. And I think, you know, if an amateur is like, I don't want to try to get to the Brier because I don't think I have a chance to win it. Guess what? That ship sailed 15, 20 years ago. You know, there hasn't been too many amateurs that don't play on tour that can go to the Brier and have a real chance. Maybe Jack McDuff was one of the last teams that's ever done that. But, you know, I think there is I think the Brier and the Scotties is needs a little bit of, we've lost maybe a little bit of, maybe lost their way the last 5 years or so. And I think that they need to kind of, it'd be nice to kind of, not rebrand, but kind of get focused on really what they are and get back to that. But that's my thoughts.
Hey, you're a perfect guy to have on, Johnny, for sure, because you and I have argued about this for years. And because, of course, like now for us, we're lucky enough that now I'm retired, but I get to go and, you know, even watch Carrick in the last few Briars. But there's absolutely no reason to go before Thursday. Like, it starts Saturday or Sunday.
Yeah.
Because it's like the first few days. Oh my goodness. Like the games are, Terry Jones. I saw an article of his after the couple of Briars ago. I think it was 38 out of the first 43 games were over early. Only I'd like to remember, and Jonesy, he'll straighten me out when I'm wrong, but it was only two or three or four games in the first half of the Brier actually had the last rock thrown. Like, oh my goodness. So, you know, people like my dad, who's the biggest curling fan there is, won't even think of going to a Brier till Thursday. I wouldn't go to a Brier till Thursday. My son's curling in it, for goodness sakes.
Right.
Because there's no entertainment value.
Right.
But the Thursday on, it's darn good. When you get the final eight, and to your point, they're all the tour players. They're the ones that travel over the world and get good at it. I guess the part that I have trouble with is, okay, why wait the first half of the week? Nobody's going to watch it. Nobody cares. Okay, the last half's great. Well, the problem, I guess, is in provinces like Alberta or Manitoba women that are so strong, you're leaving a lot of really good teams out of that Canadian championship because of where they live. A Carson Sturme, a young team that came through the university program in Alberta, hasn't been to a Brier yet. If he comes from a different province, Carson would already be in maybe four Briers by now. So that's kind of where that whole thing kind of bothers me, is the depth of the competition. Be great to have, if you're going to have 12 teams, our best 12 fighting it out for the Canadian championship.
Right. Johnny, what do you say to that, Johnny? Because I get what you're saying about it's would be fabulous and a sense of pride for a PEI or the territories or none of it to get in this thing. But 9 times out of 10, like Warren says, Johnny, it's embarrassing and they just can't compete. I appreciate that they get to go there, but some of it comes away and it's just a great, great big feeling for them. But it's our national championship. And the way it's been up to now is, I don't want to say laughable, but I think everyone understands that those teams have no shot.
Well, let me get it straight. First of all, I have nothing against none of it and Northwest Territories and the Yukon. There are some great people. And I have some great friends up there. I think when Curling Canada and all these associations tried to be so politically correct and have everyone involved in the, not only does it cost them a lot more to get all these teams there, but, you know, like, as you said, when none of it's putting a team in and they're losing 15-1 or 15. And the only reason that sometimes those games are close is because they're bringing in a player or two from Ontario or the rest of the other part of, I think that's where we've lost our way a little bit as a Brier and Scotties. That doesn't seem right. I think what they had before, where they have a territory playoff, seemed to work very well. And I know that it cost teams a lot of money to go if they were in the Northwest Territories that year, but that's where Curling Canada should step up and say, listen, have a Nunavut championship, a Yellowknife, and a Yukon and a Whitehorse. A Northwest Territories, a Yukon and a Nunavut Territory playoff. And then Curling Canada can step up and pay the way for the winners to play each other. I think that's a lot better than having every last piece of this country represented to make sure everything's fair and equal. And as a result, you're getting total blowouts.
Right.
And so I agree with that part. Wherein lies the big problem is when you, like, if you have the 12 best teams in Canada playing down, because yeah, you're right. I think that's probably a good thing to have for your Canadian championship. But what happens with that, and the major challenge that I see, is then you lose what makes the Brier great, which is your fans coming from and wearing provincial colors, wearing the blue noses from Nova Scotia, waving the white flag from up north, you know, like polar power. That's what I think, in my opinion, the tradition of Brier has been really good. And when you lose that, when you include the top 12 teams, I don't know the right solution. We've been chatting about this forever. Mm-hmm. But I think that as soon as you take away that aspect where fans feel like they don't have a team to cheer for from their province, then fans don't want to go to the Brier anymore. Then you don't fill the seats. Then they don't go to the Brier patch. And a major source of income for Curling Canada is at that Brier patch. So how do you do that? How do you do that, guys?
That's already happened, John. And I identified this in 2012. I was sitting in a meeting. I said, we've got an issue here because the world has changed. I smelt it in 2008, even 2009, that the Olympics and the Grand Slam had changed everything. That we now had professional teams, and those professional teams were getting better and better and better. And there was so much ahead of all these other provinces. And I can look back over history, really the last time we had a team from what I would refer to as a minor province do anything of consequence was Menard in 2006. Since then, I don't think there's been any teams from those smaller provinces that even scared things. We go back, we had a team from Nova Scotia in the final, and even won the Brier in 2004 and in the final in 2003 and again in 2005. Mm-hmm. That will never happen again. And I think the whole thing has changed so much. And I agree with you. The whole idea that existed there was fantastic. But fans stopped coming with those teams a long time ago. And right now, when you go to a Brier, the fans that are there with a particular team, they're family and friends. We're not seeing 200 people come from a smaller province like we used to back in the old days.
Yeah.
Because it's just gone. They know there is absolutely no chance for those teams, and so there's no enthusiasm for it. And I think an interprovincial competition that took the top teams out of it could begin to generate some of that enthusiasm again, because the teams would be equal. And I think that you'd see more participation, because you'd now know in many of these provinces, let's go Newfoundland as an example, the one year Gushue wasn't playing, you went from 2 to 3 teams playing off in Newfoundland to probably, I think there was about a dozen. And I think this would happen everywhere. And the fact that we're trying to mix apples and oranges where we're sitting today, we have evolved. And I think we have to evolve with times. And that means looking at changing this whole concept.
Okay. You got me.
Thanks, John.
I like it. It's a good perspective. And it's something, sometimes you need a veteran perspective like Warren's there. So,
well, the one thing that curling has had a problem with, John, I mean, I go back to 40 years, I've always reluctant to change. And I mean, that's been my tag forever, trying to keep things moving forward to evolve with time. And we've got to keep moving. We got to keep moving with the time or we'll get plowed under.
Yeah, you're right.
Very good, Johnny. Thanks a million for coming on. Say hi to your dad.
Yes.
You and I have a connection, Johnny, back in Ottawa. Your nanny was a girl named Beth.
Yeah, I remember Beth.
And she ended up being my children's nanny.
Holy smokes. Okay. Well, that's why we have so much in common now, Jim, don't we?
That's it right there. Yeah.
So, John, If you remember when I first met you, you were 12 years old.
No, I don't. But you still look the same, Warren. That makes sense.
Remember your dad saying, "Why don't you meet my son, John?"
Johnny, thanks a lot for taking the time and coming on, and appreciate your opinions on everything. And we'll be watching for you again. Stay safe. Look after those kids, and everyone, and say hi to your dad for us. We really appreciate you taking the time today, John.
You betcha. Anytime, fellas. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, thanks a lot, Johnny.
Thanks, John.
Yeah, you bet.
You've been listening to another episode of Inside Curling with Kevin Martin and Warren Hansen and me, Jungle Jim Jerome. And we're back each and every week. You can listen to this, of course, on a bunch of different podcast platforms. And thanks very much for listening. And we will talk to you again next week with an all new episode of Inside Curling.